Well, we are replete with doctors tonight, aren't we? On Coast to Coast. As you heard last hour on Coast to Coast, we had Dr. Sky on, Steve Cates, talking about the meteorological possibilities that would explain that recent flash that happened in the horizon sky of Phoenix. And then we had Dr. Lynn Kitai. She's a medical doctor who resides in Phoenix, who was originally very much a skeptic about the Phoenix lights until having witnessed them herself, exploring them, trying to dismiss them, and has written one of the definitive books on them, coming up on the 15th anniversary of that. And now Dr. W. Scott Poole, who is a man who grew up, as his bio says, in love with monsters, like most of us, but now he's a tenured professor of American history at the College of Charleston, South Carolina. He teaches pop culture classes and also talks and writes about monsters in America, our historical obsession with the hideous and the haunting. These are my favorite kind of books because we don't just deal in fact here, but we pursue truth, as we will in the show tonight. And tonight, we'll be talking about the marginalized, or as he writes here, the marginalized are the monstrous, and the monstrous is marginalized. The monster, more than our fears, also represents our hatreds. Whatever makes us lose our lunch, whether natural or supernatural, can be defined as a monster. The monster is the sickening other. Well, I'd like to start this conversation with where we left it off on what Dr. Lynn Kitai said about the Phoenix lights and what Dr. Poole himself might have to say about that kind of alien invasion. It's one of the chapters in the book, Monsters in America. We'll get started next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. I learned many new things in Monsters in America, our historical obsession with the hideous and the haunting. Good work, Scott Poole.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed writing the book, and I'm really looking forward to talking about it with you for a while tonight.
Good. Well, quite a while.
Thank you. Yeah, we've had a long time together, I understand.
This probably isn't the usual 10-minute radio hit you're used to doing. But also part of this, because I've read, I think, right up until the chapter on the undead in America, and I look forward to finishing the book later on. But I'm very interested in both some of the themes and then some of the new concepts even that I think you're pushing, and I really want to get to that. But before we do, let's go back a little bit.
Yeah.
And I know that you talk about the concept of the alien invasion and what that meant to us from the 50s and the 60s in the book. But here we have an unusual circumstance, and I just like your reflection on it in any way that it hits you.
Okay.
That, you know, here in the city of Phoenix, they have had three separate major citywide contacts with lights that have come in, been fairly orchestrated. One person claimed that they had done this, but I don't believe that that person was ever able to reproduce that on demand. There's video. There are thousands of people who have seen things which cannot be explained by some of the some of those things that were offered, and then just recently this explosion, this mysterious explosion that happened in the early morning in Phoenix, which nobody can track. Nobody can find out where the explosion happened, where the big ball of light is from, and we linked it up. But what, as somebody who is both a historian and somebody who thinks about monsters and somebody who thinks about our relationship to these types of subjects, what do you see or hear in that ongoing story that piques your curiosity or confirms some of your other theories?
Well, you know, I have been reading about this for the past few days, and, you know, like a lot of sightings of all kinds of, you know, prodigies and extraordinary phenomenon through history. And I mean, hopefully we'll kind of go back and talk about how even the Puritans were seeing things.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's difficult to explain exactly what they were. But what interests me about it ultimately is what these stories mean, what is at stake in the kinds of stories that we tell about phenomenon that we can't explain. I mean, obviously, the world is full of those kinds of phenomenon. And to some degree, I think that we see and that we find what we've been culturally conditioned to see and find. So whenever there's these kind of discussions, there's this kind of automatic split between okay, we've got the skeptics on one side that are going to, you know, try to give us some kind of empirical explanation for what's going on, and then the believers on the other. And I don't ever think that it's quite that simple, in the sense that, as a historian, I'm really most interested in, you know, what sort of counts as knowledge, what counts as
sure.
verifiable, and what does that these sort of events mean to people?
What?
So yeah, I mean, I don't, and in the book itself, you know, as you know, makes this in a way sort of extraordinary claim at the beginning that monsters are real, that academics ought to take monsters seriously. And what I mean by that is not necessarily that monsters have some kind of, you know, ontological reality, something we could test in a test tube or put on a table in a lab, but rather they're real in the way that every kind of social construction is real. I mean, take something like democracy. You
can't
put that in a test tube either. But it certainly has reality, and it certainly has real-world effects in the material structures of society.
All right, now, as somebody's going to be like your worst nightmare of a student, I'm going to go back to what you said, and I'm going to try to pull it apart a little bit, because I'm curious about what you said there in regard to the Phoenix Lights.
Right.
In light of what I've read in your book, is that I think the question here is, when you talk about, I think the door is open for skeptics to be able to say, aha, here's how it is. This is what happened. I think that if skeptics could step up and explain, here's the explosion, this is where this came from, or these are where all these lights came from, I think there's a large percentage of the people that right now would fall into the believer category
right.
that would switch over to the skeptic category and go,
pretty
aha.
quickly.
It was nothing. But the fact that vacuum exists, there isn't anything that explains it. There isn't anything that comes in and says, this is all that it was, and nobody can replicate it. Nobody's been able to explain the depth and the breadth and the repetition of it. That is what leads to people going, well, until I hear otherwise, I'm going to believe what my eyes tell me.
Right.
And I accept what you're saying about cultural predisposition to believing one way or another. But I think there's a lot of people who are inclined to not believe that there are, for example, UFOs flying overhead every minute, who, when they see something like that, say, until you can explain to me that that's not a UFO, I'm going to go with what my eyes say. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I think that that has been part of a much larger discussion in American history about the nature of science. I actually discussed some of this in the book in relation to the American obsession with the sea serpent
right.
in the 19th century, which is, as you know from the book, really centered on this debate between our eyewitness reports. Again, you know, what I've seen with my own eyes, is that good enough? And there were actually very many in the scientific community early in the 19th century that said, sure. A scientific mind like Charles Lyell, the famous geologist, He was a big believer in the reality of sea serpents, in part because he had collected all of these eyewitness accounts.
Right.
This actually became a part of the professionalization of science, where science and where the scientific community felt like it could stake out its claims. And one of the things that they decided after several embarrassing incidents where number of local scientific societies had gotten behind the belief in the sea serpent, only to have it proved wrong. They staked out the ground on, you know, eyewitness accounts are not good enough. We have to have something that's reproducible. We have to have something that we can experiment on in a lab. And until we have that, it is not incumbent on us to believe. And I think that's really sort of the difference there. I mean, you're suggesting rightly, I think, that, you know, for many people, it's sort of, I need you to show me why this isn't true. And
right.
I think kind of what comes at this from the other side, the more scientific worldview, is I need you to show me why it is.
Well, but I think the interesting part of that is either one, and we're talking about monsters in America, and I know that this inevitably intersects many different ways with religious upbringing.
Absolutely. I think this is actually sort of the beginning of sort of the conflict between religion and science.
But I think that part of that is it demands a leap of faith for science as well. And I think that's kind of the claim here, I think, for something like the Phoenix Lights or other phenomenon, is what science wants, and I'm not anti-science at all. I love science, and I'm fascinated with what science can and can't do. But science wants the same leap of faith that religion gets. And what it says is, although we can't prove it yet, trust us, someday we will prove that this isn't true, which is just as much of a faith statement as, say, you know, the Nicene Creed is. Mm-hmm. It asks for you to say, okay, I'm going to trust that you will some, and that whether science does or doesn't is immaterial. And sometimes often the scientists are proven wrong. I give you, for example, on the sea serpent conversation, which we should be more specific about, there was a period of time, and why don't you explain a little bit more here,
sure,
a time when sea serpents were popping up everywhere.
Oh, absolutely.
in the American news landscape.
Every lake community, every whaling ship, it seemed, was seeing a sea serpent. Not just American science for a while, but American pop culture was fascinated with it. I mean, it really kind of became, I mean, I say in the book, it really kind of became the monster of the 19th century.
And yet, what we also know is that in some respects, perhaps, some of the explanations of sea monsters might turn out to be encounters with giant squids, which had, up until a certain point, not actually physically been discovered yet, except they were being witnessed, they were being seen by, by seamen, and or the sailors were encountering them where they really were attacking boats, and they were seeing this and they were reporting it, and they couldn't necessarily be taken seriously because they had no physical proof of it.
Well, I think that's true. I think it is important to note, though, that, you know, early on, I mean, you really, before sort of the professionalization of science and, you know, the whole idea of kind of peer-reviewed research and the connection of science to the modern university and that kind of thing, that there was something more like what you described in terms of science asking a leap of faith to be made. I think that in the case of, say, one example that I came across was the Boston Linnaean Society.
Explain that, if you would.
Well, the Boston Linnaean Society, of course, it was named after Carl Linnaeus, the Swedish taxonomist, who's very famous for sort of creating this conceptual filing cabinet of the world, really, genus, species, those sorts of terms and categories come to us from him. And this New England Society was convinced, its membership, and it's actually, I should add, it's very respectable membership. I mean, some of the more important natural scientists in New England were involved in this. They were sure in about 1818 that they had discovered the spawn of a sea serpent. It was about a 3-foot-long snake that had some very strange markings that they could not identify with anything that they knew. And the society really more or less staked their reputation on this find. And unfortunately for them, Louis Agassiz, who is this very famous Harvard natural scientist, essentially proved that it was a common New England water snake that had some sort of skin disease, and that kind
right.
of accounted for the markings. And the Linnaean Society was gone by 1821, I mean, just a few years later. I think some public embarrassments like that, combined with the inability to produce a specimen in the way that was later possible for the giant squid, you know, for example,
right.
That really led to this split that you're talking about between a popular culture and a folk culture that was fascinated with these kinds of creatures and that took eyewitness accounts very, very seriously, and a scientific community that thought, you know, these claims were very ambiguous and a little amorphous. And again, until we've got the specimen in the lab, we cannot say that they exist.
Well, that's kind of the beauty of this discussion we'll be getting more into, too, is sometimes, you know, the strongest arguments against the belief in something get loudest just before they're proven to be true. So, and I only bring up the giant squid just because I think it's interesting that in light of all of the years and all of the samples and all of the underwater photography, it wasn't until 2004 that a giant squid was actually photographed in right. its natural habitat. I mean, that's extraordinary to right. think in the yeah, in the timeline of history that it took that long. And I think that the same may be true eventually for other monsters in America, perhaps, if we look at them that way, like Bigfoot. But before we go any further into that, let me ask you to define monster, because I think that already we could talk about the monstrous size of natural things, or we can talk about monsters in terms of the things that scare us that exist in the shadows that we can't see except with our imaginations. How do you define monsters for Monsters in America?
You know, actually, in the book, I start out by saying that I'm not going to define
right.
monsters, which I think has driven some academic reviewers of the book pretty crazy, because academics always like to have, you know, sharp, straightforward definitions of things.
But then you do.
Well, I do, in the sense that I think a historian defines any kind of reality. The reason I say I'm not going to give an abstract definition of the monster is that the monster has been different, and its meaning has been different in different periods of history. I mean, if I could go back to my example of the concept of democracy, it's hard to give an abstract definition of that, because you know, it meant something very different in 5th century Athens than it does in 21st century America. And so, you know, it's really important, I think, to examine monsters in their historical context. I mean, the fact of the matter is, the things that scare us change. The things that make us uneasy about the world change. We're talking about alien sightings here. That was not a monster in America before the 1940s. Really before 1947. And it's also the case that, you know, anybody that you talk with horror films about will say that, you know, when they look back at the horror films of the 1930s and the classical Universal Studios monsters, Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, you know, one of the first things people say today is, you know, that they're just not very scary. They're not particularly frightening. But people in the 1930s were scared of them. And
right.
my sense is that that's because monsters are products of the context that they come out of. And so it's hard to say the monster is always this. Sometimes it's the thing with 1,000 eyes. Sometimes it's the serial killer. Sometimes it's the sea serpent. And it all depends on the historical context.
You know, I think what's true is that if we went back in time and we looked at the monsters of past generations,
uh-huh.
Today's generation would not be scared. But if we took today's monsters and we went backward, we would scare the living bejesus out of every person on the planet. If we showed them the movie Saw in the 1938, can you imagine the impact that would have had? And it's so, our monsters today, to make your point, reflect a very different place where we are culturally. But we'll get into that coming up next. Monsters in America, our historical obsession with the hideous and the haunting. There's a lot to get to here, and I do want to pick up that conversation then about Bigfoot and about some of the other monsters, beings that were once considered monstrous, which are now thought of in a different context. We don't talk about Bigfoot as being a monster anymore. And I want to offer a working definition that I have of monsters to Scott Poole, and we'll see if that doesn't inform the conversation too coming up. Also, thank you everybody who's responding on Twitter, getting a kick out of your live reactions. You're always welcome to stay in touch that way. At Deacon Punnett is my Twitter account. And I tweeted out earlier, you know, tell me about your monsters and I'll tell you who you are. That's the subject here. Monsters in America. We'll learn about that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Learning about the history of America through the eyes of our monsters. Monsters in America. Well, more on that coming up on Coast to Coast. And also then later on this week, if you missed it in the first hour, it's always worth going back and grabbing it through the Coast Insider. We talked a little bit about the Phoenix Lights, the latest version of that was this mysterious explosion that happened the other day. And that conversation will continue coming up this Tuesday night with George Norrie on Coast to Coast. But back to Monsters in America, picking it up on with Bigfoot and maybe some of the earliest monsters in America that you never heard of, that were just as real as our monsters are today. And who are our monsters today? Are they much more real than we like to think of them? But have they taken the place in our hearts and minds where there used to be boogeymen? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So, Dr. Scott Poole, Monsters in America is the book. The early settlers, the early colonialists, as you argue, came here from other countries. They had European monsters as their backdrop, but found new monsters in America, things that scared them like crazy, things that they were convinced they saw, things that might, in fact, in some form have been there. It's just through their lens, they saw them differently. What are some of the earliest examples of monsters in America?
Well, you know, in many ways, the first monsters that Europeans believed that they were encountering were the Native Americans. And they had sort of been informed by that belief through sort of this long-running tradition, this idea that actually goes all the way back to Homer and to Pliny and to others who had written about these monstrous races that lived in other parts of the globe, monstrous races that were sort of out beyond where the maps ended. And this had long been an expectation on the part of many Europeans that, you know, once they broke out not only into the New World, but also into Africa, that they would discover all kinds of monstrous beings. And so they were sort of prepared for that in a way when they encountered Native American people. This was in part related to the idea, which became very common in Europe during the early modern period, that the New World was essentially full of cannibals. Now, cannibalism actually is ethnographically is a pretty rare phenomenon. When it does occur, it usually occurs in sort of ritual type circumstances, like we know with the Machica, the Aztecs. But Europeans were absolutely convinced that the entire New World was filled with cannibalistic peoples. And so a lot of the early representations that the English, that the Spanish, that the Dutch were looking at of what they were expecting to see when they got here really involved a monstrous vision of the New World. And that carried over pretty directly into the early treatment of Native Americans. You see that in particular, I think, with the Puritan treatment of the Native Americans, who people who were never really interested in converting the people that they found here, but really wanted to wipe them out, really pursued a sort of a genocidal policy against many of the Indians in what's today New England.
Well, you talk about an incident, I have to say, I'd never heard of. Mm-hmm. Although I guess it was not uncommon. It was, I hate to think it's as relevant as this news story from over the weekend where this soldier in Afghanistan went rogue, was apparently, he's accused of being drunk and maybe having some mental issues and went and murdered all of these innocent Afghans, you know, basically sleeping in their beds. And this
possibly a group of soldiers. I think it's actually not clear yet.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I'd heard just about the one. But regardless, the fact that this happened, I was reading your book while I was watching that news story. And in the book, you talk about how at one point some of the early settlers went on a murderous rampage and just killed everybody in a village, just almost seemingly out of some kind of mental snap where they just were trying to eliminate their fear by going into these villages and killing everybody. It sounded like the My Lai massacre.
Yeah, I don't know if I would characterize it as a mental snap. And the reason I say that is, I mean, this was part of the Pequot War, at least one of the incidents that I talk about in the 1630s. It was carried out by Puritan militia. And the Puritans, as we know, most folks know them mainly through the witch trials. And they had this real sense that they were surrounded by satanic powers on every side. And the native peoples represented that to them. Witches represented that to them. Even various kinds of natural phenomenon. Black bears, they were convinced, were diabolical creatures of some kind. And so I think that kind of their mental habit, their frame of mind, was that they were confronting satanic enemies when they confronted the Pequot and the Narragansett and some of these other native peoples. So yeah, I think you're referring to this incident along the this native village along the Mystic River near Long Island Sound, actually, where they essentially just sort of go in and wipe out everything that moved and wrote about it afterwards. I mean, this is not something anybody was ashamed of. I mean, very famous New England historian William Bradford recorded this and, said things like, as they burned, as they fried in the fire and the streams of their blood were quenching the fire, it was like a sweet sacrifice to God. So this was not seen as a shameful episode. It was kind of their understanding of the covenant people at war with the demonic.
Well, and I think this, you'll understand when I say that period was pre-development of psychology. So we have nobody there to mark that. If the past is prologue, sometimes we look at what goes on today and we can also reflect backward too and say, when people snap, they snap, and they may be very proud of the fact of what they did. That may also cover for the fact that there's a secret shame, that they know that something's wrong that they did, and so they become boastful about it because it helps to that the bluster helps cover up whatever they may actually have been feeling about how wrong it was to do what they did. But maybe I'm just cutting them too much of a break.
I understand what you're saying. I mean, there is this tendency to obviously to reframe horrific acts and either rationalize them or justify them. I mean that
right.
That happens again and again in discussions of America's 20th century foreign policy in many ways. But, I think it is important to know that, you have Puritan leaders like Cotton Mather who really develop a whole mythology of the Native American peoples where he says, these are people who are the children of Satan. That's a term that he uses. The reason that they are here in the New World is that the devil lured them here so that they would not come in contact with the gospel. And so they are a completely benighted people. So benighted, in fact, that genocide, not a word he used, but it's right. How we would describe it, is really the only
justifiable.
War to the knife to the hilt, as they put it in those days. So I don't know how much guilt that the Puritan consciousness had about this. They believe they were destroying monsters.
And yet there's also a thread that starts sometime after that with beings in the woods that we still have to this day. And I think Bigfoot is a good example of that. At one point, we look at the images of Bigfoot and the descriptions of Bigfoot, And they are very monstrous. They talk about Bigfoot as being, you know, almost a demonic beast that was going through and looking to grab children, and were, you know, and that these tribes of Bigfoot were had been organized and were the enemy. And now we don't think of Bigfoot that way. And in fact, in many states have passed laws, even just theoretically, suggesting that if you ever encountered a Bigfoot, it would be against the law to kill one.
Right.
And that's a long way from where Bigfoot started. In a way, what we see is the evolution of something like a Bigfoot, whatever it is, whatever Bigfoot is, away from being considered a monster.
Right. Well, I would say, though, about that pre-1950s, which, of course, it's late 1950s that you have kind of the classical formulation of the Bigfoot myth. Before that time, you know, it's really hard to find a creature or a set of creatures that are identifiable as what becomes Bigfoot. I think that what happens after the sightings in the Pacific Northwest in the late 50s is that you have kind of a constructed tradition where, you know, you look back and you see these sightings in the early part of the 20th century, the sightings of the wild children in Puget Sound and on some of the islands off of the Pacific Northwest, and then that gets connected to Native American mythology, some of which I guess sounds like a little bit like, you know, the wild man of the forest and that kind of thing, but I'm not sure that before the 1950s there's a really strong tradition of that creature. I think that you are right, though, that in the late 20th century, we have this idea of kind of these Pacific cryptids, these peace-loving cryptids who don't really do any harm. We actually have this regional cryptid known as the Lizard Man in Lee County, South Carolina. And I visited Lee County last summer and was really struck by the fact in a lot of my conversations with the locals that they were very concerned to tell me that the Lizard Man never attacked anybody. He attacks their cars, it turns out, but he doesn't attack individuals, and also that he's a vegetarian. They really wanted to impress that fact on me, that this is not a sort of a horrific, ferocious kind of monster. And I wonder, actually, if, and this is really just sort of off the top of my head, it's not something I've fully developed, but I wonder if maybe as in modern America, there's kind of this more of a sense that there are fewer enchanted places, there are sort of fewer dark forests. If we're sort of creating happier monsters, at least the monsters of folklore, than was experienced at one time.
You know, and I this may be a point of disagreement between us, but I'm not sure I'm willing to use the word folklore as casually when it comes to Bigfoot. And I say that because I've had on the show a couple of times, and I know other people have too, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, who is an academic who's been studying Bigfoot. And as a biologist, as a zoologist, he's convinced that there is something there. It's not to him. It's not he thinks the folklore is built around it, much like at one time folklore had been built around giant apes. And it was presumed until the beginning part of the 20th century that there really weren't giant apes.
Right.
And that it was just part of the imagination, the native imagination. Mm-hmm. And then it's proven that they are. And now they're a protected endangered species and we have them in zoos. So I guess I'm not willing to disconnect the stories of the wild men or the hairy men, or more specifically, the stories, the Native American stories. And I'm not, I think you're very culturally sensitive, and I can see your effort on doing that in the book, but I fear that if we look at it and we just say, well, that's those Sasquatch legends, that's a different thing. Mm-hmm. It's not a different thing to them. And so to them, I think they see the continuity between Bigfoot and Sasquatch, and they see the stories of the wild men or the giants, right? That was the hairy giants that existed in the woods. They see those things as one and the same.
Although although the they that you're referring to are not obviously Native Americans who first created and circulated those stories in connection with their own larger mythological systems. They are, you know, more recent contemporary people who are making connections between the media sensation, which it was, of the sightings of Bigfoot and all that, and all that went along with that, and earlier kinds of tales. And so to me, that, I mean, regardless of the whole discussion of what kinds of empirical evidence we have for these sorts of creatures, that still exists as folklore. Folklore doesn't necessarily mean it's not true, just like the term myth doesn't mean it's a fraud. And that's actually a very important point to me in the book, is that the existence of monsters has to be taken seriously by historians because people believe in them.
Right.
Their lives have been informed by them. I mean, our previous discussion about this massacre on the Mystic River, that was an actual happening. And that was an actual happening that was informed by a set of beliefs.
Right.
And so while it is not, I don't think, incumbent on any of us to believe something that there is not empirical evidence for, I do think it's incumbent upon serious scholars to take those kinds of stories seriously and to take them at face value.
Well, and I'll contrast that with the conversation we had again in the first hour about these most recent lights over Phoenix, or in the backdrop of Phoenix anyway, in this most recent case, is that there was an aspect to that which was being discussed from the perspective of the local Native American groups, and there's a couple of them outside of Phoenix, and to them, this is completely consistent with the stories that they've been passing down for generations. So there is no, there is, in a way, there's sort of no news here, because this is always what they've seen. They've always experienced these lights. And if that has been going down, if that has been passed along for generations before the Phoenix lights 15 years ago, it almost doesn't matter whether it goes back 5 generations or 15 generations, it goes back at a time that predates the appearance of the Phoenix lights, but at the same time seems to inform them. It explains them in a way which is culturally different than what many of the rest of us are coming at it from a rationalistic mainstream viewpoint.
Right. And actually that's an important part of this discussion, is that, you know, often with these, with Bigfoot, with the question of flying saucers and extraterrestrials, with the sea serpent as well, there's often, even among believers of those things, there's often this kind of fuzzy line between the rationalist believers and those who want to see these things as phenomenon of the supernatural.
Right.
So, for example, with the sea serpent, you did have in the 19th century a scientific discourse that surrounded it. You also had people claiming, well, what is actually being seen is Leviathan, this creature from the Bible.
Right.
And sometimes those two seemingly very disparate discourses, kind of crunched up against one another. I think you see that kind of in the Bigfoot community today as well, because, you know, as you and your listeners know, I mean, there's a good bit of dissension between those who would take the more cryptozoological view, these are animals that we have not discovered yet. Once we discover them, they will then fit into this larger rational framework that we have of the world. And then on the other side, those who see Bigfoot as a kind of a spiritual sign, as a kind of a portent and an omen, maybe the remnants of an older, wiser race that has something to teach us. And the same kinds of discussions happen with extraterrestrials. What I see as a kind of a historian and somebody looking at our culture in that, is that people are bringing a lot of different narratives to unexplained phenomenon and fitting those narratives, fitting those phenomenon into those narratives.
I totally see that, and I think that's a fair point. I am less inclined to believe in Bigfoot as an interdimensional being, which is an argument I've heard many times. And rather, I see both the rational and the irrational in the belief of Bigfoot, that once it's established that it does fit within somewhere of the natural world, it also, again, it jars us. It monkey wrenches us into remembering we can't be so rational about what we think we know up front, that there are still many mysteries to be explained, and that's what we'll get into coming up next. What about the monsters of Christopher Columbus? Christopher Columbus's monsters coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.